The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. In their new book, Solidarity, Leah Hunt Hendricks and Astra Taylor offer a comprehensive look at the idea of solidarity and how it can be used by political organizing movements to effect real societal change. The book is also a lively history of movements from ancient Roman revolts to Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter, and it reveals the nuts and bolts methods through which solidarity is built and sustained. Leah Hunt Hendricks earned a PhD in religion, ethics, and politics from Princeton University. In 2012, she co-founded Solidaire, a nationwide network of philanthropists who fund progressive movements. And in 2017, she co-founded Way to Win, an organization devoted to electoral strategy. She is a senior advisor at the American Economic Liberties Project and a member of the board of the directors of the Solutions Project. Astra Taylor co-founded the Debt Collective, a union of debtors, and is the author of The Age of Insecurity, Coming Together as Things Fall Apart, Democracy May Not Exist, But We'll Miss It When It's Gone, and The People's Platform, winner of the American Book Award. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and N+1, among other publications. Tonight, the authors will be in conversation with Pennsylvania State Senator and progressive leader and library favorite, Nikhil Saval. Please welcome our guests. Yeah.
Good evening, everyone. It's such a pleasure to be here with Astra Taylor and Leah Hunt Hendricks. Before we get to our discussion, I think the authors are going to start with a little bit of reading from this excellent and inspiring book. So, please.
Yes, thank you all so much for coming. I'm Leah, and it's great to be here with my co-author Astra, and thank you so much for being with us. Etymologically, solidarity relates to the word solid, from the Latin solidus, meaning of a strong, firm, or substantial nature or quality. For Emile Durkheim and later sociologists, it's a measure of group cohesion. Generally speaking, solidarity is that which binds a group, that visceral feeling of a connection and mutuality that sharing a hometown, alma mater, or favorite sports team can produce. Importantly, though, this means that solidarity is not always a positive force or driver of progress and change. These bonds can be neutral, reactionary, or transformative, depending on the community and context. Solidarity creates passionate in-group bonds, and these can justify othering, violent othering, as evidenced by the exclusionary solidarity of white supremacists, ruling elites, and jingoistic nationalists. In its reactionary form, it's the easy draw of like to like, and often aggressive in its rejection of that which is different. This is what Kevin Phillips, author of The Southern Strategy, called counter-solidarity, and what he sought to foster in order to build a Republican majority to obstruct the social movements of the 1960s and 70s. And it's what continues to fuel the right-wing forces that surge around the world today. In contrast, we are interested in what we call transformative solidarity, the kind that propelled the fight for civil rights along with other movements that have sought to expand the circle of inclusion while also altering society's very character. The force that achieved universal suffrage, won the 8-hour workday as well as the weekend, made the modern welfare state viable, defeated Jim Crow, enshrined disability rights, and much more. Solidarity has stretched across the globe, linking abolitionists in the 19th century, national independence movements in the 20th, and activists agitating for the cancellation of sovereign debt in the 21st. It's the tie that binds women, queer, and trans people, as well as workers and debtors, fighting for equality and freedom today. It's a means and an end, the process of struggling together and a way of describing the kind of society that is more just and mutualistic. Where reactionary or counter-solidarity emphasizes given identities, usually racial, religious, class-based, or national, and aims to benefit a small group by excluding those who are different. Transformative solidarity aspires to create systems that benefit everyone. Transformative solidarity points us towards the fundamental fellowship of humankind, connecting us with others despite apparent differences. Both reactionary and transformative solidarity have indelibly shaped the world we live in today, but it's the constructive power of transformative solidarity and its role as a bulwark against reactionary strategies of divide and conquer that primarily concerns us here. Historically, the question of solidarity has been raised at times of massive changes in society. Contemporary conceptions of solidarity first began to take form amid the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of modern capitalism, and in the wake of the democratic revolutions of the 18th century. As kings were deposed and the church's role as a locus of moral authority waned, philosophers and citizens wondered how society could hang together without a monarch or God. What could bind people in a modern, pluralistic, secular age? As we enter a new period of instability and change, we must ask similar questions today. What can enable us to come together despite entrenched social divisions and the immense power of self-interested elites so we can address the crises that threaten us? And more terrifyingly, what happens if we cannot?
Thank you. My name is Astra Taylor. Really glad to be here in Philadelphia with all of you, with my co-author Leah and my old friend Nikhil Saval. It's really kind of you to take the time and do this. I'm going to read just a little bit from a chapter called The Power of Numbers, which is really about movement building and organizing. Try to just condense it as I go, because we don't need a long disquisition into the nature of disability under feudalism right now to kick us off. As interesting as it is. An excellent example of the power of radical imagination in building transformative solidarity is the movement for disability justice. The idea that disabled people occupy a distinct social category first began to take shape amid the large-scale social changes of the 19th century industrial era. This was the period when workers began to see themselves as a cohesive group with a unique form of social power, and when women and also gay people, particularly gay men, began to understand themselves in new ways. Given the pervasive prejudices and physical barriers they faced, it's no wonder solidarity was slow to build among and with disabled people. And yet, if there's any oppressed group that has numbers on its side, it is people with disabilities who make up the world's largest minority, and a growing one, given the fact that every able-bodied person lucky to live long enough faces the prospect of joining the disabled community. In the 1970s, the disability justice movement took off in earnest when people began to apply insights from the movement for racial equality to their own lives. Perhaps they too were part of a constituency that was also entitled to civil rights. The mere possibility of a world that embraced every individual, regardless of physical or mental ability or health, provided motivation. Part of the challenge in those early days was that many disabled people didn't necessarily identify as such. Instead, they saw themselves as individuals with distinctive embodiments or medical conditions. It wasn't obvious to people with different impairments that they were part of the same us. For solidarity to develop between a deaf person, a blind person, a person with cerebral palsy, a person with polio, a person missing a limb, a person with Down syndrome, a person with autism, or other forms of neurodivergence, a shift in consciousness was required and an act of radical imagination. In the early days of the disability rights movement, organizing work was even more challenging than it is today. Countless obstacles blocked the way, many of them physical, such as the existence of stairs where there could be a ramp. Even when disabled individuals embraced solidarity in principle, they had a difficult time physically joining with others to put their values into practice. When the call for disability rights first rang out, curb cuts and wheelchair lifts on public buses were rare or non-existent. The channels of communication were also similarly inaccessible, which meant getting the word out could be as hard as getting out into the streets. Fortunately, activists understood that a small number of participants could have an outsized impact if they used the right tactics and had the right strategy. And so they began coordinated and confrontational campaigns of civil disobedience to vividly dramatize their oppression and demand public services and equal protection under the law. In 1977 in San Francisco, about 150 disabled radicals occupied the fourth floor of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare for 25 days. The leader, Judith Heumann, later recalled,
blind people, deaf people, wheelchair users, disabled veterans, people with developmental and psychiatric disabilities, and many others all came together. We overcame years of parochialism. The demonstrators held their ground despite great physical discomfort. The space was not meant to be lived in, and certainly not by people with a wide range of functional needs, and demanded that officials clarify and enforce existing rules protecting disabled people from discrimination under certain circumstances. Knowledgeable disabled spokespeople sparred with lawmakers about legislative proposals and televised broadcasts, and the organizers sent a delegation to Washington to further lobby officials. Brad Lomax, a member of the Black Panther Party who had multiple sclerosis, was responsible for the party bringing hot meals to the sit-in each day. The pivotal protests helped strengthen government regulations and provided an example for organizers around the country to follow. In Denver the next year, 19 disabled activists, the Gang of 19, got out of their wheelchairs and lay down to stop traffic, demanding accessible public transportation. That event directly led to the creation of the Americans Disabled for Accessible Public Transit, ADAPT, a group that's still around today, which organized similar protests across the country and brought a further degree of militancy and national visibility to the movement. Once disabled people began to organize and build transformative solidarity, they changed the landscape of the U.S. at an astonishing pace. In 1990, the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed, a groundbreaking piece of legislation that, in many ways, is more far-reaching than its civil rights era predecessor, for it requires not only that establishments open their doors to the previously excluded groups, but that they remake the entrance, widening the frame and adding a ramp or elevator. And so this is transformative solidarity. We just wanted to linger on that example and highlight the way the categories we take for granted today actually have to be constructed into being and the ways that they remake both the people who are participating in the movements and ultimately the physical world, the society we live in.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Once again, it's just such a pleasure. Welcome to Philadelphia. It's a pleasure to have you here, Leah and Astra. So, and to mark the publication and of this really timely, inspiring, and sobering in many respects book, and one that I think is, you know, especially necessary in this moment. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about the origins of the book and also your the connection between the two of you. I'll just say as well, I mean, Leah and I have met somewhat recently. Astra and I know each other from Occupy Wall Street, which we were discussing. It starts to make us feel kind of old these days. It's like we met at Occupy, and like, may come up in due course. But I'm kind of curious because I know that also Occupy as a relation is part of your sort of relationship. So yeah, if you wouldn't mind kind of talking about where you came together and how you kind of came together around this.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I can start. So for me, an interest in this topic started actually all the way back in college. It was the war in Iraq, and I was studying political theory. And the war was going on. There were protests on campus. There was a lot of organizing happening on campus. There was Students Against Sweatshops and a living wage campaign that I got involved in. And meanwhile, in my political theory classes, we would study John Rawls, The Theory of Justice, or Isaiah Berlin, Two Theories of Liberty. But in these organizing spaces, solidarity just kept being the main word. And so one day I went to the library and went down to like S and was like, where are the books on solidarity? And it was just striking to me that it's not a concept that's been really unpacked. And it's like, it's the job of political philosophers to unpack these concepts. And you know, you think back to the French Revolution, and there's liberty, equality, and fraternity, or even back to the Greek philosopher Aristotle, friendship was a key concept for him as what made up a virtuous citizen and therefore a virtuous polis. And so I began to think about how like we were lacking attention to we focus on justice as a procedural concept or freedom as like an individual concept, but we don't pay attention to the concepts that are about how we actually live together and like the relationships between citizens. So Astra and I then met at Occupy, and she was working on strike debt and doing this amazing work organizing debtors. And I called her one day because I found an article that traced solidarity back to ancient Rome, where the idea was originally about a kind of debt held in common, obligatio in solidum, where these debts where a group of people would kind of be on the hook for something together. And it actually gets, Roman law gets transferred into French law in the 1800s, and that's how it starts to become a more popular concept in French thinking, and kind of takes over from fraternity after the, like in the 1800s, since fraternity is a pretty masculine concept, solidarity, they sort of replace it with solidarity. And so I said, Astra, solidarity is about debt. It has this like material economic origin. And so that's how our conversation began.
And so in the book, you identify, I mean, there's the kind of origins of solidarity. There's a long discussion of a kind of longer book by a person whose name is, interestingly, Leon Bourgeois, who has a book about solidarity. But you also define a sort of concept. I mean, one, what solidarity means to you, but also different varieties of it. Reactionary solidarity, you started to talk about it, Leah, and transformative solidarity. So what do those mean? I mean, I guess what, if you could just sort of describe what the concept effectively means to you and what it can mean in our, you know, our current context.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are some books on solidarity, not none, but there's certainly, I don't think there's a comparable book like ours, right? Think of all the books written about the crisis of democracy that we're in. I wrote one of those books. You know, there's not a bunch of books today calling out the crisis of solidarity. So the people who have written it do tend to distinguish between different types of solidarity. And, you know, we felt that it was important to highlight the fact that solidarity isn't always a good thing. So there is, you know, a kind of group cohesion that can be exclusive and reactionary and further divide us. And so we name that as reactionary solidarity. And then there is transformative solidarity that pushes us beyond our given community, expands our sense of self, and aims to transform the wider world in larger circumstances. And so solidarity is, we see it as a kind of dual concept. It sort of has two components that are not in conflict, but or not, they're not contradictions, but they really make it what it is. And one is the way solidarity binds us together. You know, in its most basic sense, it's a measure of group cohesion. It's this, as Leah said, it's that relational concept that we're missing. So we talk about equality, we talk about freedom, but we need a concept about the relationship between people. So solidarity speaks to what holds us together, but then, and that is the tradition of these French theorists. So anyone who took sociology in college knows of Emile Durkheim, the French sociologist who wrote a lot about solidarity. He was in an intellectual formation with Leon Bourgeois, who you're talking about, who wrote a pamphlet published at the end of the 19th century about solidarity, where he was like, wow, this concept of solidarity is so exciting. We need to really grapple with it. This is going to be the concept of the next era. So that is an intellectual tradition that we don't talk a lot about in the United States. It's very French. You know, maybe, again, we learn about Durkheim in college. And then there's another parallel track of thinking about solidarity that is the labor movement, right? Solidarity as actually power, the power to change the world. So it's not about social cohesion. It's about conflict and change. And we see those as both as really united, that when we're bonded together, we can stand up for each other. And we can fight for each other, and that actually for societies to hang together, they have to be able to evolve and grow, right? There's not a contradiction there. The early thinkers, those French intellectuals thinking about solidarity, used the metaphor of the human body. So it's not, we're very clear that solidarity is not unity. It's not just let's all get along and be nice and be the same. Solidarity encompasses difference. And so this image of a body, you know, you have a spleen, you have a stomach, you have a heart, and all these parts create a whole. So a wholeness can kind of contain these differences. So our emphasis on transformative solidarity gets to that fighting spirit, right? I mean, on the one hand, we have to create bigger coalitions, bigger alliances, bigger we's, so that we can fight together to change the world, which is ultimately what Leah and I are really concerned with.
You mentioned the origins of solidarity, of the word solidarity in Roman concepts of debt and obligation. Mm-hmm. Astra, you've been involved, you know, in particular in organizing around the concept of debt and, you know, specifically against
or specifically to you know, get rid of? I mean, large quantities of student debt, medical debt. Can you just sort of talk about the debt organizing and how that kind of informs your understanding of solidarity? Yeah.
Well, there's some great debt collective organizers in the house, actually, if anyone wants to talk about debtor organizing. You have medical debt, you have student debt, raise your hands. They're here to recruit you into the movement. I mean, there are phone calls in your life that change the trajectory of your future, and that call that Leah made to me, and you know, we were talking about logistics of some movement or something we were working on, and she's like, I've been meaning to tell you this, that solidarity means mutual indebtedness, you know? And immediately I was like, that should be a book. That's, you know, there's, and that's a, that is a recurring theme of the book, this idea that we are mutually obligated. So actually, this is, this book has a lot about the positive implications of indebtedness, right? The sense that we owe our ancestors and we should pay it forward to future generations. This is what Leon Bourgeois was writing about, who's saying, wow, we're born owing so much to the people who came before us. Every word we use, every chair we sit on, every road we walk on, agriculture, this is inheritance, right? And we pay this debt forward by taking care of the world.
Martin Luther King, we quote, has this amazing quote about how in the morning we wake up and you use a towel from Turkey and you drink your coffee from Kenya and your tea from China, and by the end of breakfast you're indebted to half the world.
Yeah, and so this is this, and so there's a kind of pro-debt side to this book. It hooked me because I had been working with my comrades on something called the Debt Collective, which is the world's first debtors union. And how many people here have heard of student loan cancellation? How many people here have gotten student debt cancellation? Or had a loved one who's gotten student debt cancellation? Yeah, I mean, that is really thanks to the Debt Collective, which, you know, when we first began raising the issue of student loan cancellation, the response from the mainstream media, from Reuters, from NPR was, well, look at these ridiculous Occupy activists. The idea, can you believe they're demanding student debt relief? The government is never going to do this. And the Biden administration has erased over $140 billion at relief since 2020. Ooh. Only because people began organizing, because we began organizing and actually informing the government about the legal authorities they possessed and saying, you actually can do this. And making a bold moral argument that said, debtors, we don't want debt forgiveness. Because student debtors have done nothing wrong getting an education. We want justice, we want abolition, we want debt cancellation. We want a world where essential things like education, healthcare, and housing are public goods. And so that that process, the last thing I'll say, you know, is creating this identity of the debtor, which is something that is very shameful and stigmatized, and actually turning it into a positive identity where people saw themselves in it, even if they had actually very different circumstances or even different debt types, is kind of like the process of building the identity of, you know, the disability justice movement. And so I've learned so much from working with my comrades and from being in the movement, and a lot of that, you know, is what I brought to this book. And I just want to say, I think organizing really is thinking and learning, right? It's not like the theory comes first, or, you know, or that we need intellectuals who are only in their ivory towers. I think that we learn so much when we're actually trying to do the work of building solidarity.
Can I just linger on something for a moment? Because one, it's just worth noting that the book offers a kind of positive project and of transformative solidarity and examples of it. It also offers many examples, of course, of opposition and disempowerment and splitting. I mean, solidarity it depends on diversity and acknowledges diversity, but it also can be, that diversity can be exploited. So I'm just curious, in the example of debt organizing, and specifically student debt organizing, certainly we know, I think we can invoke all the arguments and tactics that people use to make it seem like it wasn't a project that was had broad purchase, right? That we, oh, they're just, you know, these are the most privileged people who had a chance to go to college, and yes, they went into debt, but that was their choice. You need to have skin in the game, or what, you know, like all those arguments that it would actually, you cancel debt for a certain set of people, but what about the people who didn't get their debt canceled? So I'm wondering if you can talk about how you deal with that, basically.
Yeah, I mean, so we have a whole chapter about divide and conquer tactics and the way that solidarity is actively undermined and suppressed. And I think that you just gave a good cursory account of some of the ways that these tactics were deployed on student debt cancellation. Well, what about the people who didn't get their debt canceled? Or what about the people who chose not to go to school in the first place? To which, you know, our responses are, you know, education is a public good. We live in a democracy. We want people to have access to this. And, you know, in fact, it turns out a lot of people who have student debt don't have college degrees. And actually, if you look at the data, you know, student debt cancellation is not regressive at all. The most indebted people tend to be people who lack intergenerational wealth, who are racially discriminated against, who face gender pay gaps. You know, the people who bear the highest brunt of student debt in this country are Black women, for those reasons. But I think it's really, we just touched on it in a cursory fashion because the Debt Collective has talked a lot about this, but actually student debt, the history, if you go back to it, it actually was a tactic of divide and conquer, because student debt cancellation has its origin in California with Ronald Reagan, who was then governor, who was responding to a flourishing of social movements on University of California campuses. So the anti-war movement and free speech movement at the University of Berkeley, most famously, but also the Black Power movement that was coming up at junior colleges or community colleges like Merritt College in California. And the response to these young people protesting and building solidarity was to impose tuition and fees. And they were very explicit about this. I mean, one quote we like to highlight is something like, make them pay and they'll think twice about carrying a picket sign, right? So, you know, imposing high costs on education precisely so that people do not have the luxury of becoming engaged citizens and of protesting. Yeah, and so that, I think it's important as organizers to have that historical consciousness and to remind people that, you know, these are the origins of some of the financial structures we're facing, and to build solidarity so that we can resist some of those, you know, those slurs that inevitably come our way. And we haven't done enough. I think the debt, you know, we really, you know, we could have won more debt relief if more people who are not student debtors had solidarity with the cause.
Can I tack on a little bit just to broaden to the these strategies of divide and conquer, which we go into? We think it's really important to acknowledge that there is this impulse towards solidarity, and we see it all around us. And I think the response to the George Floyd murder is an example. And, you know, some estimates were 26 million people in the streets protesting against police violence. And then the backlash started, and suddenly, you know, at first, for a minute, everyone was reading how to be an anti-racist and how to think about diversity in your workplace or wherever, and then suddenly it was like, oh no, now you're woke and you're part of this woke agenda, and, you know, people going after any kind of DEI program or literally suing wealth managers who are using ESG models, and so solidarity is, there's a real active effort to curtail it because it is threatening to the status quo. And so we think it's important to identify divide and conquer strategies, because when you're sort of equipped with those tools, you can recognize them and then better resist. And instead of thinking, oh, we did, oh my gosh, we made a mistake, I'm woke and that's bad, you know, you can be like, no, this is a strategy to divide us. Let's stick together. But, you know, so a few of the other strategies that are happening, we're seeing literally the criminalization of solidarity bail funds. Right now there's a Cop City protest in Atlanta against this police encampment and or police training ground. And this Atlanta Solidarity Fund has been bailing people out of jail who are protesting. And the Georgia legislature has made it illegal to bail more than 3 people out of jail in a year, and you have to, you know, become a bail bondsman, and it's also gone after the fund, accusing it of money laundering, and, you know, it's illegal now to help people, for doctors to help people get abortions in states where that's illegal, and or to help migrants. The Supreme Court last year upheld a law saying that you can't help migrants who've come in you know, seeking asylum illegally. So we see this over and over, this like active attempt to kind of tear us apart. And so that's part of the agenda of the book, is to say this is something we can and should resist.
One of the examples of the book that is, it's sort of paradoxical, I would say, in this context, is the welfare state as sort of an example of something that we would think of as sort of the pinnacle of solidarity, right? It's like, oh, it provides for so many people. You think about European welfare states, and even, you know, the United States from a certain, you know, in a certain period of time, is, you know, expanding the number of people it served and helped. But the book sort of suggests that this is actually, there are complications in it, right? And actually, and counterposes to the welfare state the notion of a solidarity state as distinct. Can you kind of describe those distinctions and why isn't the welfare state, it's, it'd be great, you know, I think, but like, why isn't it good enough? You know, what are the issues with it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say really quickly that it's actually related to divide and conquer tactics that Leah just laid out, because it inspired this thought experiment. What if all of this capacity, all of this energy, all of these resources were going on to undermine solidarity and to sabotage it and criminalize it, but actually to nurture it and sustain it? And like, that would be nice. And so we see solidarity operating at different dimensions. It really is interpersonal. I mean, and the book actually ends with the most personal. It ends with the idea that we should cultivate virtues of solidarity. Yeah. But we also think we can institutionalize it and, you know, put it into practice in our organizations and through social policy. You know, and this, I think, comes with maybe being part of Occupy, right? Because what Occupy is famous for is putting inequality on the agenda in class, right, with the framework of the 99% and the 1%. And that was so important to have people talking about inequality at a moment when it was skyrocketing. And so one thing the welfare state does is redistributes, in theory. And we think that that's important. I mean, redistribution is critical. Leah kind of said this. We want an economy that works for the many, not the few. But we think there has not been enough attention to actually how you sustain connection between citizens, between people in your community, and that actually is something we can orient policy towards. One example we've been going back to, I'm Canadian. I grew up in Georgia, but I'm Canadian. You know, there's a program where groups of six individuals can raise funds and make a commitment, and the state facilitates them so that they can sort of sponsor a refugee family that above and beyond the typical quota, right? So it's a way for citizens to put resources on the line, to make time commitments, but then to integrate people into their community. And it's a really popular, successful program. We also think about things of, you know, just any social policy, jobs guarantee, education, housing, transportation. What if we design those not to just be efficient, but also to encourage social connection? And, you know, that would be a very different world than the one we live in. And I think it's, once we got into the vision, we got kind of very inspired by it, because I think we actually need people to feel very invested in each other and in the policies that they're benefiting from, right? And this, I think, is an insight from organizing, that if people don't have a stake, they won't fight for something, and they also won't fight to protect it, right? And it makes it easier to roll back the gains that we get. So we really think, to have a welfare state, you actually have to move beyond it. We have to have more participation. We have to have people, the state designed in a way so that people really see their interdependence, and that is made visible.
Yeah, I think when during the Bernie campaign and a lot of the energy in those couple years, it became, you know, I would wonder, why isn't everyone excited about this? Like, shouldn't we all be excited about, you know, economic redistribution? But not everyone saw themselves as part of that project. You know, if you're already doing okay, then redistribution may not, you know, you're actually receiving, the upper classes receive benefits from the state, like the mortgage
interest deduction,
thank you. We call it the submerged state. You're receiving all these benefits. You have a good public school in your district, but people who are, you know, more dependent on, or the lower classes are kind of demeaned and demoralized by the kind of welfare programs that they receive. And we talk about the National Welfare Rights Organization in the 1960s and 70s, which was a lot of black women who were saying, you know, we're getting this support, but it's like, it's so demeaning that it's, you know, is it even worth it? So the welfare state can have this kind of dual dimension that doesn't actually pull people together and make them necessarily feel like they're part of a common project. So it felt like we needed, you know, and we've had these two kind of concepts of the state for the past century or more, sort of the liberal state where, you know, the state is minimal, let the market do the work, versus the welfare state, which is more central planning, more redistributive policies. And, you know, we were like, why not come up with a new idea of the state? You know, people have done this before, and can we be, and I think a lot of the work of organizing and movement building is imaginative and coming up with new frameworks to see the world differently and to create new visions that can bring more people on board. So that's so the Solidarity State is sort of our proposal, and we have one chapter on it. We just begin to kind of put out some of the ideas, but it's actually a concept that we hope other scholars take and run with and build out, you know, what kind of programs and platforms it could involve.
And the last thing I'll say is, I mean, you know, we are talking about statecraft as a kind of soulcraft. We don't use that word in the book, but, you know, as it shapes our character. And so there are, you know, scholars talk about policy feedback loops, you know, where people, certain policies put in place certain attitudes, certain desires, certain behaviors. And I think we need to lean into that. There is no neutral policy. And if you read some of the visions, for example, Mandate for Leadership, the big Trump 2025 plan, I mean, they're very explicit about the fact that they want to use state power to shape people's character and and roll back the Great Awakening, as they say, and impose an agenda, a culture of blessedness upon all of us. Margaret Thatcher, who was, you know, a big agent of neoliberalism along with her buddy Ronald Reagan, famously said, "Economics is the method, but the goal is to change the heart and soul." Right, that when you do, I mean, we are not just, you know, robots reacting to policy, right? But we, you know, we can organize, we can shift things. But I think policy is a powerful tool in shaping the way people see themselves and their communities and what's possible.
So that, I mean, that sort of brings me to my last question, and then I want to open it up, which is, it brings it to me, actually. Yeah. So I am a elected official. I'm a state senator. I, you know, we met at Occupy, and, you know, I was inspired. It was not a long-term plan, but, you know, several years later, a lot of the ideas kind of found their instantiation to some degree in electoral politics with the Bernie Sanders campaign, and then I felt it came like many of us came out of social movements and thought, let's run for office, you know, and it sort of, I mean, I still sort of feel this way. It was an experiment of a certain kind that many of us had not kind of considered. The left had not so thoroughly engaged in electoral politics. And now, for better or for worse, many of us are in office. And so I guess I'm curious how you...
Definitely better.
If it's, thank you. But I'm curious how this, you know, the framework we've outlined, which, you know, is extremely generative and is to me so deals so deeply with the history and sort of future of social movements of various kinds, what it offers, you know, how you think about, you know, elected officials and that sort of realm of politics, and what, you know, how you would kind of see your framework as applying to this whole thing that we've been involved in.
I really want Leah to answer this because she has much more experience in electoral politics, but I am such a huge supporter of you. When you said you were running for office, I was so excited. And from knowing you and reading what you've written about organizing too, you know, you expressed that transformative feeling of being in a movement, right? And it the way that knocking on doors for Bernie made you think, well, maybe I could build an organization, maybe I could run for office and change things. And that is really core to what we're getting at in this book, the way that organizing really does, it changes us on a personal level and expands our senses, a sense of what's possible. So, big supporter. of you.
Yes.
That's not why I asked this question.
Yeah, I think it's been a really amazing shift to look back over the past 12, 14 years. You know, the early 2010s, there were a lot of protests and social movements around the world, Occupy and the Arab Spring, and when the climate movement started gaining steam, and the racial justice movements. And then sort of 2016 to 18, there what a lot of people did turn, really in the wake of Bernie's campaign, started turning to electoral politics, which had previously been seen as kind of incremental and, you know, less transformative. So it's been amazing to see the kind of movement work and the electoral work come together. And
you haven't just seen it. You've been part of that.
Mm-hmm. that's my partner. it's been amazing, and it's really challenging and very expensive, and, you know, touches on, we have a chapter in here on philanthropy, and part of how philanthropy can distort solidarity and kind of draw people towards more palliative solutions. And, you know, because there's a 501c3 tax deduction for non-electoral things, it can be hard to convince people to fund the electoral campaigns of exciting new candidates. And so, yeah, I think it's electoral politics is a tool in the toolbox, and it's the outside work is still necessary. I don't think a democracy works if elections are the only time that you get to participate and have a voice. I think we really need to keep the community organizing and the neighborhood organizing and the movement building going and connected to the electoral work. But, you know, I think the uncommitted campaign, just to go right to Israel and Gaza, is an example of using an electoral tool to make a statement about how, you know, a lot of Democratic voters in many states are using their primary vote to make a statement to Biden about what they want to see from him in order to vote for him again in November. And it's a daring and maybe controversial way to use your vote. But this is kind of what votes are for, and how else can people have a voice? You know, there are limited tactics that movements have. So, yeah, I think it's been a time of real experimentation, and I feel like we're just, you know, I've been a close observer, had a good seat to watch Pramila Jayapal, one of the congresswomen from Washington State, build the Progressive Caucus. And, you know, she's building infrastructure in a congressional caucus think tank, and it's growing and growing with Greg Kassar from Texas and Max Frost from Florida, and a lot of young people who were teachers or nurses or community organizers are stepping into these roles, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
Great, thank you. So I think...
Do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah.
You have some experience.
Well, some. I would say that it does still feel, you know, like an experiment, you know, I mean, in the sense that it was not, for very few of us who were in elected office, you know, who came out of social movements, was it our long-term goal to be in elected office. We were organizers, you know, and for me it was the labor movement and the Sanders campaign, you know, and for so many others that was their path. And then it was seen that this would be, you know, many of us were recruited. It was like, oh, you should run. You know, it was like, let's see what happens, you know, and let's see what happens. We have movement politicians in office. And there's this great article by Mark and Paul Engler about this kind of distinction. You know, what is a movement politician? What do they do differently? What is relationship to social movements? Can you sort of effectively co-govern? What does that mean? And I think we're all actually still figuring that out. I think there has been some clear success and difference, you know, but I think it actually sort of still remains to be seen what the distinctiveness is of this movement, this contribution. And I think it also still remains to be seen, you know, I think there was this hope that we would
running for office would not have any detrimental effect on social movement activity. On the contrary, we would grow it, right? It would be an extension of this work. It would have the feel of social movement work. It would drive more people into issue-based campaigns. And I think that's also still sort of meant to be seen. But I think it derives from this notion that we could build broad, multiracial, working-class coalitions around sort of universal issues, you know. And so it has been fruitful for me to think about the book in that context, just given the work that we've done together.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say that organizing is always an experiment, too, especially, you know, I mean, I think Occupy was so imperfect in many ways, and, you know, my favorite sign of Occupy was, I love democracy more than I hate this drum circle. Right? That it was annoying, but we went anyway because it was the space to actually talk about the important issues and to find each other, to find so many amazing people who kind of went like moths to the flame and were like, we actually want to make a difference. But we were organizing in the wake of this long, long, successful war on solidarity. And so, you know, you see this incredible revitalization of the labor movement. You see left-wing people trying to run for office and build connections with social movements. I mean, I guess I just want to say, you know, we're taking the risk of experimenting, and we also had to build a lot of stuff from scratch. And I think one of our goals is to leave people who are younger than us more infrastructure, more tools than we had.
Yeah. So would love to open it up to the audience for questions. There is a microphone.
Thanks, you guys. It's just been glorious to listen to you guys talk about solidarity. And as someone who's kind of trying to study in this realm, you know, not to your level, but it makes me wonder what undergirds solidarity. And I think of Hegel and Hanna's notion of recognition. And how do we build recognition in order to have solidarity? And has that come into your work at all?
Hmm. Wow, I would love to hear you say more about that. I do think recognition is, you know, the fact of difference, being able to see like the other as different and yet their own agent, their own protagonist, is, I think, something that is fundamental to. I mean, it's what we all crave, and it's we're all kind of seeking that and desiring that from each other, and so I think, yeah, that's very much part. And I think that's part of why solidarity is different from things like charity or benevolence or altruism. I think we call these sort of semblances of solidarity, but really they're about your acting upon another rather than kind of that recognition of mutuality and shared fate.
Yeah, I mean, just to the, you know, I was going to say exactly what you just said. We do identify the semblances of solidarity. So just saying, I feel your pain, or I empathize with you, or I pity you, those are not solidaristic relationships. And so I would say part of the recognition we are encouraging in this book is to recognize your own self-interest, right? I mean, people who are relatively well-off, even very well-off, I think have a lot to gain from a solidarity state, from recognizing that, you know, like, it can sound abstract, our fates are interlinked, but we really do, as we know, breathe the same air, we're, you know, sharing the same overheated planet. And so I think, you know, in some philosophical discourse, the recognition is always, you know, out there. And I do, you know, the mutualism we're trying to uncover is, we think, really real and really important. This is not, you know, this is an altruism.
Hi, thank you for coming.
Thanks.
So I really enjoyed, Leo, what you said about a lot of the work in this realm is sort of imaginative. And I'm curious about what you think about the idea of having transformative solidarity in a way that's sort of like not adversarial. And so, you know, you mentioned like right-wing backlash. Like, how could those folks be brought in, not necessarily the folks that are doing the dividing and conquering and looking for ways to do that, but just folks who might, you know, go along with that. How could transformative solidarity sort of be seen as something that is for everyone?
Yeah, I mean, we think of, you know, transformative solidarity is different from reactionary, not because we just like don't like what the reactionary people think, but they are like structurally different because transformative solidarity has that open door, and it's like it wants to be more inclusive and to bring people in and to listen and to like grow together. And so, yeah, we have a lot of examples like Frederick Douglass and Martin Luther King Jr. who are always, you know, I think it's Frederick Douglass who's, you know, says, "I'm against slaveholding." Do you remember the quote? "I'm against slaveholding," but he was open to talk, you know, to working with slaveholders, I think.
Or if they changed, right? Like, it was against the system, not the...
Yeah, against the system, not the people.
Like, I will work with anyone on something good, and I'll work with...
Yeah, so it's drawing lines. It does draw lines, and we do think that some kinds of polarization are important, but it's really important to identify the right enemy, and often by identifying who really is doing the dividing and conquering, you can grow the coalition and help people see themselves as actually on the same side. That's why we loved, part of why I think we loved Occupy was that 99% vision was so broad and inclusive, and most of us do have a lot in common. It's mostly just Elon Musk who... No, I'm just kidding. But I think that that's exactly the goal. How do we not become, you know, purist and exclusive ourselves and like fall into the trap of our own kind of reactionary orientation, which maybe I was by talking about Elon Musk, but we can all grow.
Thank you all for coming, and Astra, I came to thank you for writing The Age of Insecurity.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, because I learned so much about the enclosure movement and about, you know, the slow drip transformation of usury into something that is really a, you know, a tool for control. So I've kind of come to the conclusion that, you know, that we need to redesign money. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering whether in your network there are other people that you might know who are thinking about that.
I mean, I would quickly highlight just efforts to make finance public. So there is efforts for public banking. I mean, I don't, you know, I think there are lots of steps we could take that go or fall short maybe of redesigning money, but actually turning our financial system, turning money into a public good. And that would certainly, there's actually quite a few, if you like The Age of Insecurity, you might like Solidarity. Because there's some reflections on public finance and how that actually would be essential to funding some of the efforts that we're talking about. But absolutely, money creation and means of financial exchange have been captured by private interests and need to be returned to the public
good. Yeah, I've been involved in the
public banking. Yeah, public banking is a really good thing to be involved with. So we definitely talk about that a bit. Thank you for reading.
There's lots more in the book. So, but first, I just want to thank our authors. Thank you, Leah. Thank you, Astra. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Nikhil. I do think it's important, talking about solidarity, though, to talk about things you can do. We do want to invite everyone to join the Debt Collective, www.debtcollective.org, and volunteer for Nikhil Saval's campaign.
Yeah.
This is a really special elected official here, and I think that we need many more like you. So I'll come down, too.
Well, so thank you all for coming. Thank you to Andy and the Free Library for hosting. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.